Stephen works for the National Research Council of Canada, where he has served as a senior researcher since 2001. He specializes, many of you probably know this, in the fields of online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy. Just realized I should be recording this. Recording started. Right, so I'll just start that introduction again. Stephen Downes works for the National Research Council of Canada, where he has served as a senior researcher since 2001. He specializes in online learning, new media, pedagogy, and philosophy, and is a fierce proponent of openness in education. And by way of introduction, I want to refer to a great post that I found on Stephen's blog the other day. He was actually blogging in support of a comment that George Siemens had made, and George Siemens was railing against what he called the watering down of the term open in education. And this is what Stephen put on his blog. I'll let you read it. On that note, Stephen, that's just to show we have high expectations of you for today, and I'll stop talking and hand over the mic to you.
Okay, well, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. Oops, okay, there we go. Always helps if you click the microphone button. Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here, and please don't have too high expectations. It's 6 a.m. on a Sunday morning here in Las Vegas, where I am. I'm here attending an IEEE conference where I presented on digital rights management yesterday. Today's talk is somewhat different from that. We'll be looking at pedagogical foundations for personal learning. I'm not completely happy with the presentation. I know you're not supposed to say that up front, but some people might look at this and say, oh yeah, this is more typical down stuff, but there are some things in this presentation that I'm working through for the first time. There is a awful bridge between concepts about two-thirds of the way through the presentation. So what I'm saying here is that I'm trying some ideas out for size, and I'll be looking forward to your reactions and your feedback on those ideas, and we'll see how they go in the future. So with that introduction, I'll begin with this chat, and then as Gabby said in the introduction, and thank you, Gabby, for the kind introduction. I'll be stopping every once in a while for comments, and also if you want to interrupt me while I'm in mid-sentence, please feel free. Just pop up a hand, and Gabby or one of the other moderators that is on can stop me and interrupt me, because they can speak right over top of me. And please do that, Gabby, because I won't see the hand, and I know it's right in front of me. It's going to be about this far from my eyes, but I won't see it because I'll be in like mid-flight, right? And so although my eyes will be working, they won't be inputting information, as I've learned this from experience. So yes, yeah, wait for me to stop for a breath. Okay, anyhow, with that introduction, I guess the other thing is, you know, this will be, I guess, kind of a pretty informal presentation. So if it doesn't follow the slides exactly or the program exactly, that's not really going to bother me at all. The presentation is for all of you as well as for me. And so, feel free to take this off into some sort of different direction. It's fine. All right. Pedagogical foundations for personal learning. Where's my little arrow? There it is. Oh, my little arrow doesn't work. Why doesn't my little arrow work? Huh. I don't seem to have control of the screen. I've been demoderated. So I'll have to wait for the organizers to moderate me. it probably happened when I lost connection just during the warm-up. Okay, I've been re-moderated again. That's much better. Thank you. All right. So here's where we are in this particular moment of history. We're in this transition from the virtual learning environment to the personal learning environment. Those of you who are in Britain probably remember the somewhat raucous session at the Alt-C conference on the death of the VLE. We're migrating from virtual learning environment, aka learning management system, to the personal learning environment. This is not just a shift in technology, but as I will argue in this presentation, it's a shift in how we view learning itself. And in fact, this shift in how we view learning is the more significant shift. I mean, who cares about the technology, right? This is the more significant shift and is going to reshape, or ought to reshape, how we look at pedagogy. So, what is the VLE? The VLE is a large device intended to manage learning. I don't even want to get into what we mean by managed learning, but the diagram is suggestive with curriculum mapping, assessment, tracking, tutor support, student record systems, all of that sort of stuff. That is the management of learning. The PLE, by contrast, and you can see this diagram I borrowed from Dave Tosh, which he borrowed from Scott Wilson, which people have been messing around with over the years, is to manage connections. The PLE is the software application or software environment, and people can interpret that how they will, that allows you to manage your connections to people and information and services around the internet. As Alcan says in the chat room here, the PLE is shaped by the availability of the personal technology, which is this is exactly right. The technology that is available is what shapes the management of your connections. What that produces, I argue, is two distinct kinds of knowledge. Now, these kinds of knowledge have been identified before today by people who are much more steeped in the discipline than I am. But we can draw these out and make them clear. Knowledge in the VLE typically is static, it's declarative, it's authority-based. It's the sort of thing that's prepared in loving detail ahead of time and put into the VLE as though it were like books on a shelf in a library. Knowledge in the PLE, by contrast, is dynamic. It's changing. It's not the same today as it was yesterday. It's like dipping your toe in the stream of a river. It's tacit, non-declarative. That's a hard thing to wrap yourself around, and we'll spend a lot of time talking about that in this session in various ways. But it's important to keep in mind that knowledge in the PLE isn't just what is contained in the words that are exchanged between people who are in networks of PLEs. Knowledge in the PLE is constructed or grown or developed. It's not something that comes as a result of a pronouncement from on high. It's something that comes about as a result of the interactions between people in the network of PLEs. The PLE, and this is the first great inference of this paper, from the perspective of knowledge, if we think about it, the PLE is an environment for a person to manage connections, and whatever that means. And, you know, there's a whole story that could be told about how people manage connections. It's not part of the story we're telling here, but there is a big story to be told about that. Knowledge, when we think of it as dynamic, tacit, grown, or constructed, consists of a set of connections. So the PLE is an environment for a person to manage knowledge, whatever that means. In other words, the PLE is a knowledge engine for a person. Okay, where do we go from there? Well, it gives us a picture of what the PLE should be, first of all. This is a diagram I created a number of years ago. It's a diagram that describes how I conceive the construction of a personal learning environment. And where's my little arrow thing? I don't know if you can see that arrow on the screen or not. So I'll use the little line thing. Sorry, I'm just trying to do drawing. So basically what we have in the PLE is a place to input content, a place to work with content, and a place to output it. And then there is the environment that surrounds this individual PLE. The idea here is that there is a flow of content that runs through the system. The PLE is a personal knowledge management system, a personal knowledge management creator. I try to instantiate this in a piece of software called Grasshopper. And I have released Grasshopper as open source software. If you use Google, you can look it up. And what Grasshopper is, basically, is a tool for managing connections. And you can see in the diagram some of the connections that exist between entities in Grasshopper. And we use this in the Connectivism course. The content and the people in the Connectivism course that was offered last year and the year before by George Siemens and myself was scattered across the internet in a wide variety of different applications and platforms and the like. And what Grasshopper was used for was a system to allow a person, namely myself, to draw connections between these things and to make those connections clear and manifest. So we have a picture, therefore, of the PLEs, not simply as these knowledge management engines, but also the picture of PLEs as working in a network. So we have one PLE communicating with another PLE, and so on. Okay, so where's that going to take us? Well, typically, the next step that people take when we start talking about PLEs this way, and it's not an inaccurate step to take, is that PLEs are basically instances of social networks. So if we think of one PLE per person, here we have a person, that's a PLE. Here we have another person, that's a PLE. Here we have another person, that's a PLE. And the whole idea of a PLE is to manage the connections between all of the people who are in that network. So it's going to manage all of your individual connections to the other people. And so we have all of the PLEs connected in the network, and we have that typical star diagram that we see as the individual PLE for the individual person. And as Harold Jerky, hi Harold, says in the comments, each PLE is unique. You notice how the connections that this PLE here has will be very different from the connections that this PLE up here has. They will look quite different from each other. And interestingly and similarly, the software environment, the nature of those connections, all of those will be different and unique as well. This is an important point, and it's going to come up later in the discussion. The uniqueness of each individual in a network of personal learning environments. But for now, we're just at the social network part. Okay, nothing too controversial there so far, really. You sure can. Yeah, I'm sorry about the Starbucks. Normally I would drink Tim Hortons, but I'm afraid that it's the Starbucks that's open all night here.
bit of unintended product placement there. I think my voice is echoing. Can you try?
Oh, yeah.
Turning your mic off for a second, Stephen?
Done.
Okay, let's see if that's better. The issues that have been coming up are primarily around assessment. People are saying institutions need VLEs because they need access to what the students are getting up to as evidence of learning for assessment. And then questions are coming in about what should institutions recognize as evidence of learning, and what is the relationship between assessment and accreditation. So that's a whole area that's been going on. And another parallel stream has been the question of ownership of the learning, that obviously the PLE, the ownership of the learning and all the knowledge, is very firmly in the place of the learner. So what is the link between that and the accreditation assessment issue? So if you'd like to briefly address that. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, what I'm actually going to do is put off the discussion of the assessment, because I'm going to want to talk a bit about the nature of the knowledge before I talk about the assessment of the knowledge. I hope that makes sense. So I want to defer discussion of the assessment of knowledge. With respect to the ownership, sorry, did you want to respond or say something?
No, go ahead. I think you're going straight onto that. It's just Pal's question, Palitha's question, that also seems to be summarizing some of the earlier discussion about ownership.
Okay, well, that's fine then. With respect to the ownership, I want to defer that, and we'll come back to that maybe at the end of the discussion, because questions of ownership aren't really part of this discussion. I can see why they would come up and be relevant. You know, in the short, the short version is everybody owns their own work, their own knowledge. The longer version of that is you own what is unique to you, but there is very little in any communication that is actually unique to you. So these discussions of ownership become pretty complicated, and they shade into discussions of the appropriation of public knowledge from the public commons by individuals and the classification of that as a commodity that is owned. Much in the way that, for example, British Petroleum attempted to appropriate a color, a certain shade of green, and say that we own this shade of green, or here in North America, the way Walmart attempted to trademark the smiley face and say we own the smiley face icon, and the nod to Brian Lamb, who's noted how the Olympic organization has appropriated our cultural history of Olympics and the symbol of the Olympics and the name of the Olympics and all of that, and made that its own, when clearly it had passed out of copyright sometime in the year 200 BC. Anyhow, so I can shade that back into more discussions of ownership, but I want to talk about more what it is that is owned. Finally, somebody asked to me to talk about the distinction between PLEs and PLNs. How do I say this politely? The PLN is a marketing thing. There is no distinction in my mind, except that there was the PLE, people came up with the PLE, people were talking about the PLE, and then a few pundits who were on the speaking circle here in the United States decided to call it the Personal Learning Network in order to establish some branding and personal identity for themselves. That's the history of the PLN. But otherwise, there's no distinction really to be drawn between a PLE and a PLN. it's not a unique concept. You know, it's the same thing, this appropriation of ownership of ideas that are in the common environment. You know, this is something you see quite a bit. You're welcome, Al. I'm happy to demystify, although somewhat controversially, I suppose. Ooh, big long message from someone here. Oh, from Al again? I can't tell because the... No, from O-Runner. Alright. So, let's move now from social networks to the next stage. And from social networks, we typically get the move into a discussion of social learning, a description of some kind of theory of social learning that will depict, and here I'm thinking especially of George Siemens, but you know, a lot of people, depicting learning as some kind of external process or set of processes. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I'll give you some examples of what I mean. Social learning, learning defined as external processes, we see it in behaviorism and instructivism, where learning is described as a set of instructive procedures, a set of behavioral responses, or we could describe learning in terms of interaction and interaction theory, a transactional theory of learning, the things that Moore talks about. Or we can talk about social constructivism, constructed meaning, socially constructed meaning, zones of proximal development, all of that from Vygotsky. Or we could even make concrete the object and mechanism of learning as external objects such as problems. And we even see problems in Freire. So we have these external problems, and these problems are going to be the concrete mechanism that we will use to facilitate learning. All of these are of a type. And what they are is a step from the idea of learning as some sort of social phenomenon to the mechanics or the pedagogy of learning as the description of some sort of social process, method, object, or some such thing. See, I don't really like the way I'm expressing that, but I think you get the gist of what I'm trying to say here. Drawing that out a bit more explicitly, some aspects of social learning that these types of learning, these types of pedagogies have in common. First of all, externally based definitions. And let me be clear, when I say externally, what I mean is outside the individual learner, outside the person who is learning. So, for example, we have learning objectives, which may be created by the organization offering the learning, or the organization paying for the learning, or the organization testing the learning, etc. Typically, also, there is an externally defined body of knowledge. A person, when they are learning, is expected to learn about some kind of body of knowledge, where we say that that body of knowledge exists externally prior to the person who is doing the learning. Or we can talk about externally based processes. Processes that are described and take place outside the individual. Sorry, I'm a bit short of breath here just because of the early morning, so I'm trying not to breathe heavily, but anyhow. So we have these learning activities, learning processes, conversations, etc. The whole mechanism, the whole assembly that we call interaction and communication. We have external systems. And here I'm thinking of Scott Wilson and this channeling of Stafford Beer and the whole system-based model of learning. Classes, networks, groups, collaboration, all of these kind of discussions. You know, I'm also thinking of Jilly Salmon and you know, the moderating, the e-moderating kind of thing, etc. Zane Burge. All of these are external systems for learning. Harold Jarchi puts up a nice nice link to social learning in the chat room there. And then, and you can see how why I wanted to kind of put off this discussion, external evaluation. Evaluation of a set of external performances, markings, instances, tests, behaviors, etc. Things that are seen as social phenomena outside the learner. Again, I'm drawing a wide swath through a large number of theories and identifying these aspects of these theories that they have in common. We could argue around the edges of these things if we wanted, but I don't think we can argue about the concrete center of these. These approaches, these typical pedagogies, are externally based pedagogies. They are external to the individual. They are instances of social learning contrasted with what I call personal learning. Social knowledge is distinct from personal knowledge. Now, I describe that at length in my paper, An Introduction to Connective Knowledge. But what I want to say is that social knowledge is the knowledge that is had and created by a society. It is the knowledge of how to fly a 747 from Paris to New York. It is the knowledge that is the taxonomy of all the living species. It is the knowledge that consists of a language, the rules of grammar in the language, and all the words in the language. It is knowledge that is thought of as a set of social artifacts, a set of objects, etc. Personal knowledge is distinct from that. Personal knowledge is not composed of those things. I'll talk in a couple minutes about what personal knowledge is composed of, but it is not composed of the elements of social knowledge. And social knowledge development, the creation of knowledge that is held by a society, isn't a type of learning. It's a type of research. We as a society, when we create knowledge for that society, we could say that the society as a whole is learning, but we call that research. We don't call that learning. Learning is something that we apply to a person, not a society. And the product of an educational system, as opposed to a research system or a social system, is not a social outcome. It's not knowledge, skills, taxonomies, etc., etc. It's a personal outcome. It's something about the person rather than the society. Personal knowledge consists of neural connections, not social connections. When we talk about learning in a network with personal learning environments, what we are talking about is using a network to create an organization of neural connections in an individual. And if you look inside a brain, you don't see facts and languages, you don't see theories and taxonomies, you do not see the knowledge of how to fly a 747 from Paris to New York. You see neural connections. And Fred asks, do neural connections take 10,000 hours to wire? The short answer is yes. The long answer is, neural connections are not the sort of things that, you just start assembling them and creating them, right? That's not how you build neural connections. Neural connections form as a result of well-known associative processes in the brain that occur through experiences that are had by that brain, or the person who owns that brain or is that brain, depending on what your personal ontology is. So, I mean, I go into this in detail in other papers, but the essential thing here is that a connection between two neurons will form as a result of a repeated series of experiences in which those two neurons fire in a reasonably consistent manner. That's simple Hebbian learning. There are other principles, but the idea is it takes a series of firings of neurons for connections to grow between those neurons. Yeah, so we don't want to overdo the Gladwell 10,000 hours myth. Again, it's one of these numbers that's picked out of the air. It's fake science. It's not real science. Different connections will take different amounts of time to join. You can form a connection between neurons in an instant. If you know, everybody has had that experience. You have a momentous, life-changing experience, and bam, a whole bunch of connections form. And you know, they reinforce because you keep thinking about that experience after. But connections can form very quickly, and other connections can take a long time to form. There's no way of instantly acquiring the knowledge of how to throw a dart and get a triple 20. You just can't do it. So some connections form instantly, other connections form slowly. You know, if you have a undesignated pie in the sky thing that you call a discipline, then you can pick an undesignated and pie in the sky number like 10,000 hours, which constitutes quote-unquote knowledge, that is to say, a set of neural connections of that discipline. Pausing for breath. Does anyone want to jump in and comment at this point? And I'm seeing nobody, so I'll plug my thing back in here.
Stephen. Been a little bit of conversation going on in the text box between... sorry, we're getting that echo again. Could you just turn your mic off for a second, Stephen? Thanks. The conversation is going on between Fred, who's leading a session at 6 p.m. GMT on the open context model and the Beatles and O Runner and a few others who are talking about the open context model. I don't know if you want to respond to that or if you want Fred to briefly explain what he's the connections he's making.
Go ahead, Fred.
Okay, no worries, Fred. We'll be hearing a lot from you later, so that's just a preview for anyone who's interested. Stephen, please go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to continue then and forge forward, although for the sake of the audio recording, I want to point out that Fred is referring to something called the open context model, which is something worth following up. Now, I'm on slide 19 of 44, and I've got 5 minutes. No, just kidding. But, okay. Let's translate this into some of the common elements of learning that we've all grown up with, know, and love. For example, learning outcomes. On the externally defined picture of learning, the externalist pedagogical theories, learning outcomes are simple. Now, simple is something that can still be pretty complicated, but they're simple in the sense that they are concrete, They are, what's the word I'm looking for? Atomic. They can be realized propositionally. For example, the sentence Paris is the capital of France. To contrast that with learning, when we think of learning as personal learning, the outcome of learning is not going to be something simple like the sentence Paris is the capital of France. Rather, it is going to be a set of neural connections. This is important, and it's something that a lot of commentators in education don't get. Let's picture ourselves in a classroom, say, and let's picture ourselves in an environment where the educational task is to teach that Paris is the capital of France. And the model is something like, we will present the information that Paris is the capital of France in this context. We'll work with it in some way. We'll have students reproduce it in some way. They'll talk about it in some way, blah, 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 blah. There's all these processes and such. And we depict the outcome of that knowledge as Paris is the capital of France. But in fact, the outcome of that learning experience is only very partially, sorry, only very partially and almost unidentifiably Paris is the capital of France, but rather a whole set of things that we can very loosely describe as propositions that may include Paris as the capital of pants and or of France, and also includes things like the instructor wore blue pants. It is snowing outside. There are 14 people in this classroom. I don't like the person next to me, etc., etc. There's a whole complex of mental states and experiences that happen in a learning situation, even when we designate the purpose of that learning situation to be Paris is the outcome of France. And importantly, they are all also outcomes of that learning. That is why it is not sufficient to compare two types of learning situations simply by looking at the objective, teaching Paris is the capital of France, and the outcome, did they learn Paris is the capital of France? Because the outcome of one learning method may be Paris is the capital of France, and I'm okay with that, and the outcome of another learning process may be Paris is the capital of France, and I hate people with blue pants. So we need to think of learning and learning outcomes not as these simple things, but as these complexes of neural connections, something that we can't wrap our textual minds around. We have to see that as importantly ineffable. It is a state of mind, a development of the individual that is a learning outcome. And it's hard to characterize the difference. We think of learning that Paris is the capital of France, or learning geography as an assemblage of these kind of facts, as some sort of knowing that, or knowing how, some kind of set of learning. But really, what it is what it feels like to have geographical knowledge from a personal point of view, what it feels like to be a speaker of a language. Learning a discipline is a total state and not a collection of specific states. To quote unquote know geography is, in a fundamental and precise sense, to be a geographer. Where what I mean by be a geographer is to have the physical constitution, that is, the set of neural connections that we would call being a geographer. And the way we know as individuals, as persons, that we are geographers is that we have the feeling that we are a geographer. Now, you can talk about assessment. We'll talk about assessment, how we validate that feeling. But it's a subjective, personal ineffable feeling that we are a geographer that constitutes that knowledge, not the collection of individual facts. That means that learning to be a geographer is not exposure to a set of particular states or particular knowledge entities. Yes, that feeling is emotional, Gabby. It's like any feeling. It's a feeling like a feeling. You know, it's, and this is what distinguishes geographers from non-geographers. A geographer is happy about being in that state. A non-geographer would rather be in a different state. That's the difference between knowing and not knowing. The desire to learn manifests itself originally with a feeling of unhappiness at being in the state that we are now and wanting to become or wanting to be in a newer, better state. I know I'm throwing wide, waving generalities around, but again, it's because these things are ineffable. They represent total states of mind rather than collections of individual states of mind. We don't express the knowledge of geography, the knowledge of being a geographer, as a set of individual activities and bits of knowledge, but rather functionally. Can you perform as a geographer? If you were put into a room of geographers, would you stand out or would you blend in as one of them? There are no necessary and sufficient conditions to being a geographer. Sorry, product placement there. So here's where we come to outcomes. Here's where we come to assessment, to assess whether a person is a geographer. It doesn't make sense, and in fact, it's illogical to measure bits of knowledge or competencies or anything like that, but rather a person's capacities as a geographer in a network of geographers. In other words, as the diagram shows more clearly than I can explain, which is ironic because I made the diagram, we recognize this, a particular mental state, by a person being in this, a network of geographers. So, putting that aside, here's another concept that comes up a lot. Shared understandings. What is it for one person to learn what another person knows? Again, we get this picture that learning, if person B learns something that person A knows, the result of that is some kind of shared understanding between the two of them. That in this diagram is identified as the between. And in the little diagram up here on the right, we see this expressed another way where we have the same picture in each person's mind as a consequence of this externally managed process of learning. So the picture is, right, somebody has a picture of a tree in their head and they go through some kind of process and the second person will have this picture of a tree in their head. And so we have the same tree, sorry about my drawing of a tree, it's the best I could do, the same tree as the quote-unquote content of each of their minds. And I want to argue, and I think I can make the case, this is not biologically or physically possible. You cannot have the same concept of a tree in two persons' minds because the individual's minds, having been experienced or having been exposed to a welter of different experiences over life, will be very different. Your picture of a tree is different from my picture of a tree. Ineliminably. The only way they could be the same is for us to have identical neural structures, and that's not possible. Well, it's logically possible. It's pragmatically a 1 in 10 billion chance, or actually a 1 in 2 to the 10 billion minus 1 chance. Rather, communication is more like this. You're in your solitude, I'm in my solitude. We have communication events that go back and forth. In the middle of that is a syntax, a physical grammar that allows for the communication to take place. This grammar can be specified informally, it can be specified implicitly. For example, there is a grammar of speaking and listening where the speaker produces sound waves and the listener receives sound waves that creates a mechanism for voice to be heard by a hearer. There are all kinds of other ways of creating syntax for communication, but the semantics, the meaning of that communication is individual to each person, and that meaning in turn is dependent on context and other factors. Just looking at the comment from O Runner here and the Education Futures Resources timeline link that he shares. So, we have a distinction between process, which has pedagogical import, a distinction between cooperation and collaboration. Because when we get into learning as social networks, we get into discussions of social learning, one of the first things that always seems to come up in the discussion is some sort of mechanism of collaboration, of teamwork, of forming communities, of doing joint projects, etc. But there's a big distinction between the collaborative process and the cooperative process. Collaboration assumes as essential a fiction that we share goals, objectives, methods, etc. That we have from the previous slide or the slide before that, this between us that forms the basis for this collaboration. But these things that collaboration assumes are ineliminably semantical properties and hence irreducibly individual and complex. They are what it feels like, right? And we can't share these things. We can say, yeah, we share a feeling, but let's use those words literally, right? Is it possible to share a feeling? And, you know, what am I feeling now? It is not possible for me to share what you, or for me to share my feeling. The best we can say is, I have a feeling, you have a feeling, and we'll come to some sort of syntactical understanding about those feelings such that we'll give them the same name, and we'll call that sharing a feeling. Cooperation, by contrast, is a mechanism of sociality that assumes only an interaction at the point of interactivity. That is to say, only the sending and receiving of messages and signals. Cooperation, therefore, does not require what collaboration does, and that is that the two entities be the same type of thing. You can cooperate with a tree, but you cannot collaborate with a tree. You can cooperate with your pet dog, but you cannot collaborate with your pet dog. So, we have models of learning that are based on the idea of social construction, and I mentioned some of them earlier in this talk, but really, social construction is, at best, the creation of social artifacts. It is, at best, the creation of social knowledge. And in that, it can be process-driven, results-oriented, consensus-based, all of these external factors that I talk about. But social construction is not a mechanism for personal learning. Personal knowledge is not constructed. You do not make meaning for yourself. Rather, it is a matter of organic growth. Developing personal knowledge is much more akin to exercising than it is to inputting, absorbing, or remembering. Think of the personal learning environment, therefore, as being like an exercise machine. It's not a machine for gathering content and storing it in yourself. it's a tool intended to immerse yourself in one of these networks, in the workings of a community. The PLE is a treadmill. That's good. Once you are immersed in this community, in this network of people who are sending communications and cooperating with each other, then you can practice at being one of the people characteristic of that community. For example, you would learn philosophy by practicing being a philosopher in a philosophical community. You'd practice learning geography by being a geographer, that is to say, doing the kinds of things that geographers do, having the kinds of communications that geographers have in this geographical community. And your growth develops as a consequence of your interactions with that community. And we can now be more precise about the sorts of interactions that result in personal growth and development as a geographer or a philosopher in an appropriate community. And probably the closest that I've seen to that sort of model is the model of constructionism proposed by Seymour Papert. And it's not surprising that he would propose such a model, because he's one of the leading proponents of the idea that cognition is the result of a process of neural networks and neural network development. He, along with Marvin Minsky, was one of the earlier proponents of connectionism, which is a connective theory of cognition. And so we have constructionism, the idea that we learn by manipulating materials. We learn by getting ourselves into these communities and creating things and sharing them with these communities and getting feedback on them from these communities. Sorry about the word collaborative. In this quote, obviously, I would want to say cooperative rather than collaborative, but people are less precise with language than I am. The constructionist approach is personally focused on properties of the mind, and we can talk at length about what those properties are through a personal learning environment, which is depicted here as a computer. And notice in Papert's approach, you can interact with people, you can interact with a program, squeak, small talk, etc. You can interact with an environment if you're a physical chemist or a geographer or somebody who interacts with environments. All of these, you know, you can cooperate and communicate with all of these things and get feedback from them. Learning is inherently cooperative, constructionist, but it is not inherently social. You don't have to learn from other people. Otherwise, we would be convinced by the argument of the very improbable conclusion that a person who does not exist in a society would learn nothing whatsoever. And we know from the constitution of human brains that that is simply false. I'm almost done my talk, because I'm almost out of time.
We'll give you an extra 5 minutes. I'm sure our next speaker, Rod, won't mind starting a little late, and Lucio, who follows him, because we did start your session a bit late. So if you can finish in the next 5 minutes. And for everybody's information, we'll have your slideshow and this recording available on the conference website, and there is a discussion forum there for asynchronous discussion to carry on these issues, because you're raising so many really interesting issues here, Stephen. So back to you.
Okay, well, thank you for the extra time. Put things back in again here. So I'm just trying to record your comments and my comments, which means every time there's an interaction here, I have to unplug and plug in things like my earbuds so that they get picked up by the microphone. Okay, here's the beginning of the awkward bridge, but I still think it's really important. We're at the point now where we're talking about the pedagogy, where learning really is the development of personal capacities. And what that leads us to is a pedagogy very similar to, but in important ways distinct from, because Freire was much more socially inclined than I am, but a pedagogy that is based on the individual empowerment of the learner rather than the creation of certain states of being, of certain states of affairs, certain knowledge states or skill states of the learner. The idea of learning in a PLE is about the development of capacities. It's a theory of learning that is based on the empowerment of the learner rather than some specific, identifiable, concrete, propositionally described properties that are somehow instilled in a person. And, you know, I so want to distinguish between these two because, you know, we can talk about a person and personal development, personal growth and all of that as though it were like, oh, they've learned to do communication effectively. Oh, they've learned to negotiate at a bargaining table. Oh, they now know all the elements in a periodic table. And that is not the model of personal development, personal growth that I'm talking about. What I'm talking about here is the large and complex, in an important way, ineffable set of skills, not even skills, dispositions, not even dispositions, mental states, precisely neural network states, that allows a person to effectively function within a network of practitioners who are what we would call instances of a certain practice. Sorry about the really convoluted sentence. If anybody's interested in this later on, they can come back through the recording and parse that sentence. So the idea here is that the use of a personal learning environment creates, through that use, a personal empowerment, an increase in a person's capacity to function as a philosopher, say, in a philosophical community, or a geographer in a geographical community. And Al's asking, well, what arguments can be used to promote the use of PLEs in in institutions such as universities? Probably none, because the model of a discipline, the model of knowledge in a university, just is a set of knowledge bits, a set of propositional knowledge, and a set of skills that are individually defined. That's the whole idea of a test, is to identify your performance vis-a-vis that set of skills or that set of knowledge bits. But in fact, being a philosopher isn't having any of those skills or knowledge bits. It's rather being able to function effectively and feel good about that in a community of philosophers. This doesn't imply that universities have no role, but rather that the role that universities serve is not personal learning. It is social learning. Universities create social knowledge. They create research. In learning, we immerse ourselves in a network. In a network, we communicate with other entities in what may be very broadly called a language. Becoming a philosopher is becoming fluent in the language of philosophy, where by language I mean something much more broad than simply a set of sentences, words, and grammars. And so, if we want to talk about the pedagogy of learning in a network, we're talking about basically critical literacies in the languages that characterize that domain or that discipline. This is a very simple frame that allows us to discuss critical literacies in different disciplines and domains, and is simply a taxonomy. It is not reflective of an actual internal state of that communication. The meaning, the grammar, the syntax, etc., of a language in a given discipline is, as Wittgenstein would say, the use in that discipline. And so it can change, it can be fluid, and it does, in fact, evolve on a daily basis. Very briefly, we have syntax, everything from rules to patterns to similarities. All of these things are the sorts of things acquired by a person who becomes fluent in the language of a discipline, but they're not, again, acquired as specific separate entities, but rather as part of the overall complex of learning to be a person who performs such and such a discipline. Semantics, similarly, how do you see the world? How do you interpret statements in the world the way a philosopher would, or the way a geographer would, etc.? The different kinds of associations that are formed, the different ways of decisions and making decisions in a discipline. You know, geographers come to a disciplinary consensus, come to conclusions about geography in slightly different ways than philosophers do, in radically different ways than mathematicians do. The pragmatics, the way we use language to do things in a discipline, the way we ask questions, the kinds of questions that we ask, the way we create meaning, I'm using the word create loosely, through use in a language. Cognition, the way we reason in a discipline, the way we define things, the way we explain things. Context, how we explain, the set of alternative possibilities for a given explanation that we would consider as viable within a discipline. Again, how we create meaning or vocabulary as a result of instances in a space of possible instances. Thinking of, the difference, the trace that Derrida talks about, the frames that Lakoff talks about, change and how change affects the discipline, the sorts of flow. We can think of flow as historicity or directionality. We can think of change and flow is how things become more or less important. We can think of change as progression or change as stasis. We can think of change as scheduling, events, activity theory. All of these form aspects of knowledge. When I say something in a discipline like Paris is the capital of France, we represent that as a single item of knowledge, but elements of all six of those frames are implicit and intimately involved in that statement. And each discipline would apply those differently to the same fact, Paris is the capital of France. And that's why I say learning to be a geographer is seeing and interpreting, absorbing, learning, reading the sentence in that way. It's a whole brain approach to the understanding that Paris is the capital of France. So the only way to get at it is to see how you react as a whole brain in the community of similarly constructed individuals. And it's kind of an interesting thing and an important thing. In a certain sense, only a philosopher can recognize another philosopher. And there's an aspect of this whole theory of testing that wants to short-circuit that, as though we could have people who are not philosophers through some sort of mechanical process tell whether or not a person is a philosopher. But in the end, the only way a person can be thought of as a philosopher is by being recognized by other philosophers. So we have a PLE pedagogy. The six frames are the elements of the language. Learning in a PLE involves immersion in the community that uses this language and communicates, involving a reflective awareness of these six frames, thinking about these six frames. And then pedagogy is modeling these skills, providing feedback along these frames. I know that's a very short version of a very long concept. And that is my talk. And if there's any comments or questions, I'd be happy to take them at this time.
Stephen, thank you very much. I'm afraid we really are running out of time for a extended kind of discussion that I think some people would like here. We've had loads of questions and comments coming in the text box, which you're probably seeing now. What I would like to suggest is that we continue this discussion in some way in the open domain, perhaps linked to your blog, Stephen, because the conference website is only available to people who've registered for the conference. And we've got some people coming in, especially for the session, who are not enrolled in the conference. Is there some way we could continue the discussion on your blog?